From KCPW in Salt Lake City, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. The environmentalist Edward Abbey once said, "If time is the mind of space, the river is the soul of the desert." As its soul, rivers bring life to the arid landscapes of the American West, feeding the flora and fauna which call this rugged terrain home and creating the dramatic canyons in the Red Rock. And those who live on and love rivers say rivers lead to introspection and inspiration. A new documentary captures the power, beauty, and rare isolation of five Western rivers, the Colorado, the Rio Grande, the Salmon, Yellowstone, and the San Juan. And today on the program, we're talking about these rivers and their place in the West. Plus, bringing bees into the garden. All that and your calls after the news. Good morning. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. The American West is certainly defined by its deserts and wilderness areas, but its rivers make life in these rugged areas possible. From whitewater adventures to spectacular beauty to life-giving waters, a new documentary captures the essence of five major rivers from the Canadian border to the Rio Grande. Today on the program, we're talking about the importance of rivers in the West and also to our species for both body and soul. Joining me this hour is Ken Verdoya. He's director of production at KUED Channel 7. Ken, thanks so much for being here.
Great to be back.
Also with us, Roy Webb. He is multimedia archivist at the Marriott Library Special Collections. He's a river expert, a river historian, and author of five books, including Green River Explorers, Adventures, and Runners, Call of the Colorado, and his latest is Lost Canyons of the Green River. He joins me in studio. Roy Webb, it's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you very much.
Later on in the program, we're turning to pollinators in the garden and protecting them. But first, rivers of the West. If you're a river rat or hike to the shores of the Colorado or the San Juan, how do you explain the allure of the water? What keeps you going back to the rivers of the West? Give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Roy Webb, I want to start with you. You write that it was a girl who introduced you to what would become your longest lasting love, your love of river running back in 1975.
Well, I was born on the banks of the San Juan River. I mean, my family lived in Farmington, New Mexico, and so we lived in a point of land between the San Juan and the Animas Rivers, and that was where we always went as kids to hang out down in the Cottonwoods. That's where you'd go. I always say you'd go to smoke a stolen cigarette, drink a stolen beer, steal a kiss from a girl. That's where we played army and everything. But in 1975, I was had a crush on a Mormon girl here in Salt Lake City. I was living here, and her ward was taking an outing to the Green River below Flaming Gorge Dam, and so I went with him. It was just a little one-day trip, the little seven-mile stretch down to Little Hole. And I went with him just really to be with her, but the river really captured my attention more than her.
What was it about the river that called to you?
What I've always liked about rivers from growing up on was that they always ask a question. There's where have they come from? Where are they going? They're just so intriguing, and there's so many moods to a river. When I was growing up on the San Juan, sometimes we could walk way out into the river on the sandbars, and on the ice-rimmed sandbars, sometimes it was just huge and swollen and muscular with whole trees going by. And there were just so many different moods and so many different questions that it asked. And I've always wanted to know the answers to those questions.
Ken Verdoya, the documentary Five Rivers, Five Voices, produced by John Howe, will air tonight on KUED. The footage is stunning. What was Howe trying to capture in film about rivers?
Well, essentially what Roy is getting at, that moving water is life. I mean, if we look at our own lives, when we use metaphors that are similar to water in describing our life, our lives are going through a peak of activity. It's like we're running a rapid. Things slow down. We become stagnant, and we associate stagnant water with still lack of life. What John Howe does in Five Rivers, Five Voices is really look at five signature pieces of moving water in the American West and five individuals who consider their lives inseparable from those places. And to run down the list, we have the Middle Fork of the Salmon River, the Yellowstone River, the Colorado and San Juan Swan Rivers, of course, near and dear to Roy's heart and our hearts here in Utah, and the very controversial, very unique Rio Grande River.
Rivers are controversial, but this film doesn't really delve into the politics of river control and conservation. Why did he decide to focus on the beauty?
Subtextually, it does, because if you look at that, each one of the rivers that's profiled has a varying degree of protection. All water in the United States of America has some semblance of a protection on it. But certain rivers are protected as being very unique. The Middle Fork of the Salmon River runs through the Frank Church River of No Return Wilderness. It's a wild and scenic river. The Yellowstone River through the heart of America's signature national park. Very, very well protected and if you will, an iconic piece of flowing water. But others, like the Rio Grande, run dry from use. They also form an international boundary. And our guide, our signature voice, our man on that river, is in fact a national from Mexico who comes to the United States, runs canoes through the Big Bend National Park, beautiful location, but knows very well the indelicate balance between north and south that is symbolized by the Rio Grande. So even though there are no overt political statements, each one of these rivers calls to us as an American citizen to say, understand the water, understand the historic role of water, the way it lured people from Lewis and Clark to John Wesley Powell to the West to try to define this country.
We're talking about the new documentary, Five Rivers, Five Voices, which will air tonight at 8 o'clock on KUED Channel 7. More information on our website, kcpw.org. And if you'd like to join us, if you're a river rat, what calls you to the riverbanks? 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. I want to play a clip from Five Rivers. This is the first river that's featured, the Salmon River. Before we hear it, maybe Roy Webb, tell us a little bit about this Middle Fork. It received wild and scenic status in 1968, and as the film points out, it is free-flowing and undammed.
Yes, completely undammed and wild and scenic river, and a very highly prized permit. If you're a river runner, Idaho has a lottery system, and so it's really hard to get a permit on the Middle Fork, but it's a absolutely beautiful stretch of river. It's so different than what I've always run. I mean, I'm used to the Colorado and the Green, which are muddy and big and muscular. And the Middle Fork is certainly muscular, but the water's clear. And I remember on the first time I did it, I didn't look at the scenery above me because I was looking through the water at the rocks because the water was so beautiful and clear and so many great places to stop. There are hot springs everywhere and historic ranches, and it was an absolutely magical trip. It was just a wonderful experience for me.
And Jennifer, the reality is we are all river rats. If you've ever gone on a trip down the river, no doubt somewhere in your group there will be a first timer. And what you find is they're very, very tentative when they first approach the water. They're kind of in awe of the natural setting, whether they're putting in at Lee's Ferry or wherever they might be in starting a river trip. But by the time they get taken out, something happens with them between put in and take
Absolutely.
Out. And they get drawn into the current. They get drawn into the rhythm of the rivers, because even if you have an oar, you're completely at the mercy of the rhythms, the natural cycles of that river. And it's wonderful to see. We all become river rats. We all want to live our lives in sandals and shorts and waterproof parkas as we hit a rapid.
Darn it. If you're making me want to go there right now. I want to – oh, please, Roy.
That's what I love about it, too. And I always say it's the inevitability of rivers. Once you put on – you know, you start at Lee's Ferry, you start at Sandwash, wherever you start, you're locked into that. And there's no more decisions to make. There's a great quote from a guy – who was two guys who swam down the Grand Canyon in 1956, Bill Beer and Jim Daggett. And Bill Beer wrote a book called We Swam the Grand Canyon, the true story of a cheap vacation that got out of hand. And he says that he came to Lava Falls, and they were swimming. Remember, they had life jackets and wetsuits, and they were swimming. And he comes to Lava Falls, and they stopped, and they looked at it, and he thought, well, maybe we should walk around this because it's such a huge rapid. So he said, no, he'd float down. So he got in the water, and he started floating toward it. He said he kind of exercised like a boxer, you know, to exercise his moves. And he kept looking at the shore thinking, I could still swim over there and get out. I could still swim to the shore and walk around. And he said, finally, I felt the current take me, and there were no more decisions to make. Which I love that about rivers, that once you put on, there are no more decisions to make except getting up in the morning, going to bed at night, finding a camp, making dinner, those kinds of things.
And the river never makes a mistake. people make mistakes on the river, but the river never makes a mistake.
No, it's been doing it for a million years.
I want to play this clip from Five Rivers, Five Voices. This is a river guide, Bronco Brunchak, I believe is his name, who is on the Salmon River.
Come here. I think one of the most special things about the wilderness is what it does to you as a person. It has a positive effect on you, and you don't have a choice in that. It leaves you a better person after you've had that experience.
To leave in some of that river noise because it's so alluring. What do you think he means by leaving you a better person, Roy Webb?
I think it's that same thing. It simplifies your life. You stop worrying about, you know, when I have a job with a lot of responsibilities and a lot of staff and a lot of memos to write and everything. And I'm thinking about those all the time when I'm at work and at home. Even at home, that's churning through my mind. But I get on the river and that just drops away. And the thing I notice at the end of the trip is that I haven't thought about anything for 5 days except the canyons, except maybe I have a blister on my foot, maybe it's cold or rainy or something. But you don't care because it's just so all-encompassing. It's like you're brought into this environment this environment has been going on for millions of years. And all of a sudden, you're a part of it, and you just forget about all those other things around you.
Let's talk about the environment. The water has been there forever, and yet rivers have changed over probably the past 100 years specifically. Roy Webb, in what ways, just generally, have rivers in the West changed?
Well, certainly the Colorado River Storage Project, the big dam projects were major, major changes. I mean, the Colorado River went from being a big, muscular, muddy, warm water river with species that were accommodated to that had been for millennia to a cold, clear water stream that's pretty highly regulated. It's really rare to find a stretch of the Colorado, certainly, that's not regulated. The Yampa River is about the only one, actually, and then some of the smaller streams. But so that's been the major, major change, and that's changed the not only the water itself, which has become clear and cold coming out of Flaming Gorge Dam, Fontanelle, Glen Canyon Dam, but also the environments, because the dams have stopped the floods, the annual floods that used to go from in the old days, the Colorado and the Green would almost dry up sometimes, or they'd freeze over in the winter. But then in the spring, there would be huge floods as all the snow in the mountains melted, scour the riverbanks. After the dams were built, the environment changed where species such as tamarisk were able to grow because they weren't washed out anymore. And so they were able to grow and just create a whole new riverbank environment that had, on the one hand, is home for like the willow flycatcher, which is an endangered bird, which never could live along the Grand Canyon, say, for instance, before. But on the other hand, they've pushed out native species and made it hard to find a place to camp, kind of thing. So that's been the major change. And the other is ever-increasing use. I mean, there's so many people that want to divert water off the river for development, for industry, for agriculture, that it's become where you almost have to time. Sometimes if you want to float a river, you have to time it to know when the irrigators aren't going to be taking water out.
And we've come to the point now, I think what becomes clear in the documentary Five Rivers, Five Voices is we are coming close to, we are over allocating the moving water in the American West. And a way to think of this, Jennifer, is to say, I'm getting a $100 tax refund from Utah State. This is tax day, so why not use that analogy? And that $100, I could pay a bill, or I could buy tickets to a concert, or I could use that $100 towards my summer vacation. And what we do with that same $100 is we allocate it three times because we think, oh, each one of these is a good use. The problem is when you start planning and reallocating something many, many times, thinking you can do all three of those with the same $100, you quickly find that you've over-allocated the strength of that resource. What we have with moving water in the West is the Colorado River running dry before it reaches its historic outlet in the Pacific Ocean. We have the Rio Grande River running dry. Our river runners, if you will, Ernesto and his crew, have to pick up their canoes and walk it through certain stretches because the Rio Grande, this mighty river, is down to 2 or 3 inches of depth in certain areas.
In addition to the changes that man has made on rivers, I think the film dramatically shows the changes that seasons have on rivers. And John Howe has shown us through the snowstorms up in Yellowstone and the driest conditions down by the Gulf of Mexico.
Well, again, going back to that simple premise that rivers are alive and they are very, very seasonal. In their heyday, as Roy alluded to, the Colorado River in spring runoff could just rage. In fact, back in the 1930s, they would characterize it as the great menace that needed to be controlled. We have to dam the river so that we won't have horrific downstream flooding during the spring runoff. You see these live rivers. You see Yellowstone, particularly in this film, the bison that close to the area, the life that takes its life, not just from the hot pots that warm wildlife, but also the running water that provides that sense of structure and life for ageless wildlife in the Yellowstone ecosystem.
We are talking about rivers and what waterways mean in the American West. With us this hour, Ken Verdoya, director of production at KUED Channel 7. Roy Webb, he is an archivist with the Marriott Library Special Collections, but also a river expert and river historian. His latest book is Lost Canyons of the Green River. And if you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number. The documentary Five Rivers, Five Voices will air tonight at 8 o'clock on KUED. If you share a respect and love for rivers or have a favorite river tale to share, give us a call, 801-355-TALK. We need to take a break. We'll be right back. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. We are talking about rivers this hour. We're talking about the documentary Five Rivers, Five Voices, produced by KUED Channel 7. It explores the physical, aesthetic, and spiritual power of rivers. It airs tonight on Channel 7, and more details on that in a bit. But joining this hour to talk about the importance and the majesty of rivers in the West is Roy Webb. He is the author of Lost Canyons of the Green River, and four other books about rivers in the West. Also with us, Ken Verdoya, director of production at KUED Channel 7. And you can join us if you like. Why do you run difficult rapids or search for a quiet eddy? What is the allure of rivers in the West to you? 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. I want to play a clip from the documentary Five Rivers, Five Voices. This is one of the river guides starting us out. Her name is Sarah Sidwell, and her voice is followed by Terry Tempest Williams.
So here we are at Butler Wash on the San Juan River, and this is a perfect example of early basket maker period rock art. The basket makers were farmers in this area. They used the bottom lands in this area and a little bit further downstream to grow all of their crops, simple crops such as rice, grass, and squash. And then later on, when the Anasazi came in, they would grow things like corn and beans and stuff like that. They also left their mark on this panel, but it's not as prevalent as the basket makers.
When you come onto these panels of pictographs or petroglyphs, the first thing you want to do is imagine what were they trying to tell us. And perhaps we'll never know.
That's Terry Tempest Williams and Sarah Sidwell from the documentary Five Rivers, Five Voices. There is a lot of history to be found along the rivers of the West. Roy Webb.
Well, because that's where the water was. There was the West is so arid for the most part, so dry that if you were going to survive, if you're going to homestead, if you're going to have a ranch, if you're going to farm, if you're even going to just live, and even earlier that, of course, European history or Euro-American history, you were looking for beaver, and they were found on the rivers. And so the rivers were a draw because of that. You couldn't live in the West. You couldn't live without the rivers. You know, if you go east of the 100th Meridian, you could. I mean, the landscape is much more lush. There's much more water sources and things. Not in the West, not west of the 100th Meridian.
Mm-hmm. And one of the incredible aspects of river running. We always talk about rapids, and we want to talk about lava falls and how breathtaking it can be to run that at high water. The reality is that if you take the time to look around beyond the geologic wonders, you find literally the handprints of humanity going back a thousand years. And when Roy takes it up in his book, Lost Canyons of the Green River, or when you see the inscription of Denis Julien near the Green and Colorado River, who was a fur trapper from long before pioneering settlement in Utah, you gain this sense of people living in place. And then along the San Juan, as we were hearing from Sarah, you see not only the rock art, but the magnificent structures and granaries that still stand long after the basket maker period, long after the so-called Anasazi period. These people gathered near these water spots because it gave them life, because the river was, once again, life to these formative peoples in the American West.
And the river is really the best way to get to some of these very remote places.
Well, in some respects, it's the only way to get to them.
It is. Absolutely. Some of these places are, it's so hard to get to overland. It's impossible to get to overland. So a lot of the places that Ken's talked about in the San Juan, certainly in the Grand Canyon, there are many, many places like that where I was just thinking what you said about the handprints. There's a great place in a place called Deer Creek. As you go back through a little grotto, you climb up a waterfall, upside a waterfall, and go back through a little grotto. And there are sprayed handprints that are just tiny, where they took in some kind of material in their mouth and sprayed it around their hand and left an outline of their hands as you're going through this. It's almost like a spiritual journey as you go through this little grotto. And all of a sudden you come out into this big, open, hidden valley. And you think, what were they? They must have been so impressed by this. I mean, this must have been a spiritual journey, some kind of religious ritual in a way. I mean, it couldn't help but be. Mm-hmm. And to see those marks like that and know that they were there is really just, it's just an amazing feeling.
So in some ways, the river inspires introspection. It also tries to give you a place in the spectrum of humanity.
It does. And I was thinking about what Ken said, too, about a lot of people are drawn to rivers because of the excitement of running rapids. But I have a good friend, a guy named Brad Dimmock, who said he's not intimidated by the lack of big rapids. And by that, he meant that it's not just the rapids, it's not just the excitement, it's the quiet stretches, it's the beautiful stretches of river. My own favorite stretch of river is Labyrinth Canyon, Labyrinth and Stillwater Canyons on the Green, where there are no rapids at all, absolutely none. It's a canoe. I actually floated an inner tube one time for a 10-day trip. And it's just so beautiful, and you feel so much a part. It's like you're a part of the bloodstream of the earth as you're floating down that river. And it just makes you emotional.
Well, and you have a stretch, for example, the Middle Fork of the Salmon, less intense rapids, but more constant rapids. So you have a very unique character there. But when you go, for example, down the Colorado through the Grand Canyon, as Roy talks about, you have extended periods where you're just floating. And those are some of the best ones because you're just in this current, moving along, the canyon is starting to rise and announce itself around you. You're gathered usually with friends and family in this close little pack, and you start recognizing that you don't have your cell phone on, you don't have your iPad on, you don't worry about what's on television, and you're not worrying about what's at work. What you have is your humanity and the incredible power of nature. Now, okay, Roy and Ken start going off the deep end, waxing rhapsodic, but to listen tonight in the documentary to Terry Tempest Williams, gifted naturalist, beautiful writer, talking about the emotional consequence of what it means to have moving water and have that as part of your life, truly is. It just resonates.
And I think one thing Ken has touched on here, too, is that the community, I mean, the river community is a very small one, a very tight one, and it's like you're an instant friend if you happen to be in Moab or you happen to be up in Salmon, Idaho, and you start talking to somebody, you're going to know people, you're going to know the same people, and it's that same community of feeling. You know, everybody that goes on the river has those same, they come away with those same kinds of feelings, and so it's almost like you have an instant friend. You know, you may not have ever met this person, and you may never see him again, but there's such a close connection because you've been on that same stretch of river. You've felt that current, you've felt that fear, that anticipation as you come to a rapid. You've drifted along in those slow stretches, you've looked up at the walls, you've seen the wildlife. It's you're just bonded.
You
just
spend like 3, 5, 7, 10 days in a wooden dory on a moving river with some intense rapids. You have bonding experiences that will stick with you for many, many years to come.
Ken Verdoya, director of production at KUED Channel 7. Also with us, Roy Webb, a river expert, historian, and author. And the documentary Five Rivers, Five Voices will air tonight at 8 o'clock on KUED Channel 7. I want to play another clip from the film. So much of the power that water has over us is sound. So this clip, this is the narrator, Peter Coyote, as well as Robert Redford. And we'll take a listen and get your response.
The sound of oars dipping into the river combines with the distant roar of rapids. Often, there is only silence.
I think that the beauty of wilderness is so powerful when left alone that it does go into that new realm of magic.
A new realm of magic. Is that what you hear when you hear the sounds of the river, Roy Webb?
Absolutely. I was hearing it just now, thinking about that, or thinking about it just now, hearing those sounds and thinking of all the times, you know, the overpowering sound of a big rapid, but also those little quiet gurgles and noises that, you know, when you're camped in a quiet place and you can hear the river, you hear wildlife, maybe you hear a beaver slap his tail or something. Those kinds of things really are in the realm of magic, and they really do take you out of yourself to the point where you feel so connected to that, with that environment.
Where we are today in the heart of a major metropolitan city in the American West, if we were to go out and truly listen to what our environment sounds like, we would hear the strong presence of machinery, of people in motion, of industry, of commerce, of man being very, very busy, humankind being very busy, making a lot of noise doing it. You get out on a river, and all of a sudden that all falls away. And the river is the soundtrack for your life. And one of the most heart-accelerating moments is when you hear a rapid announce itself around the next bend. Mm. You know it's coming on the map, but it's nothing until you start hearing that water build in tempo, build in depth, in timbre, and it starts rumbling out to you. And that gets your heart beating so fast as you anticipate it. It's joy, it's excitement, little bit of I've got to be on my toes, here
sure.
It comes. It's just the river is your soundtrack. And that's so different from what we get in our daily lives. And like Roy, whenever I hear it, I yearn for it.
Roy Webb, give us a glimpse into the mind of a river guide. What's going through your mind as you approach something that's really difficult?
I was just thinking of something that Edward Abbey said, that he said that running rapids is, well, I guess I can say this, it's just like sex. It's 90% anticipation, 5% approach, and 5% ecstasy. So what's going through your mind? I always joke that there are times, certain rapids, you get to Upset Rapid or Lava Falls or Crystal in the Grand Canyon. Last year, I happened to be in Lodore when the water was really, really high. And here, going to River Stories, there I was, is how River Stories always start.
River Stories, yes.
So we were in Lodore, and the water was at 12,000 CFS. And Lodore, the Canyon of Lodore and Green River and Dinosaur National Monument is a tight, narrow canyon that runs north and south, so it's really gloomy. And we were on a commercial trip, and one of the boats flipped in Triplet Falls. And the boatman hurt her arm. And so I remember I was just along on the trip as historian and interpreter. And I remember, she was standing there holding her arm, and it was swelling. And everybody turned and looked at me and said, well, Hell's Half Mile is right downstream, Roy. And so you're going to take her boat down. And I remember walking down there. And it's one of those, you almost feel like you wish you'd never been born. You know, you just think, oh, God, I really, how could I be here in this? How did I put myself in this position? But then it's really hard to describe. You just accept that responsibility and you think, I've got to do this, and I've got to do it right, as Ken said. You've got to do this right. You've got to think it through. You've got to react. And I remember we ran it, and so my daughter was on the trip, and she's become a river guide. She said, I'll go with you, Dad. So we went. We did a good run. At one point, we got hung on rocks, and I was really proud of her because she just threw herself to the side, started pulling on the boat to get it off the rocks. And you just have to – instinct takes over. You just react, and you've had a lot of experience doing this in the past, and your instincts take over and you get through. So.
And this is not the log flume at Disneyland,
no.
Where you know what the outcome is. Yes, you're going to have that great screeching ride down and hit the water. But when you are in control of a moving vessel on a river, anything can happen. Even the most experienced river guide can have a slight miscalculation and get flipped, and get flipped in some really difficult area. One of the people profiled in our documentary, Martin Litton, who is a legendary figure on the Colorado River, as he's working with us, this is a few years ago when we videotaped him, he's the oldest man to self-navigate down the Colorado River, at least in contemporary times.
Yeah.
He loses an oar in the middle of a rapid. So here is this man in, at that time, his mid-70s, with one oar, standing up in a wooden dory and almost shouting at the gods in defiance as he negotiates the last couple of critical turns. It's a magnificent moment, and it's just so singular. One man, one place, one time.
I want to bring Martin Litton's voice into it because he is so powerful. You can't talk about rivers without mentioning
Absolutely.
Martin Litton.
Looking back, if anyone were to ask me what I take the most satisfaction from in terms of ecological or environmental successes, or let's say less failure than otherwise would have occurred, I would say probably my part, small part, in stopping the building of the dams in the Grand Canyon was one.
Doing the same thing in Dinosaur National Monument, Echo Park. I plastered the newspaper with articles, and I think they had an effect. I think they changed things.
That's Martin Litton from the documentary Five Rivers, Five Voices. He is a giant of conservation. How else can rivers in the West be saved, be preserved? What more is there to do, Roy Webb?
Well, it's the, like with any other thing that you feel passionate about, you get involved. You know, you call your congressman, you join groups like the Utah Rivers Council, for instance, the Sierra Club, even the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance. You become involved. You get engaged in those efforts to preserve those places. You write your congressman. You donate money to things, to organizations that are actively working to preserve those. It's an uphill battle in Utah because a lot of people view the rivers as just another thing to be exploited. I mean, and, you know, you can't blame them for that. They want to live here. They want to have those things. They want to water their lawns. But at the same time, those places deserve their own respect. They deserve their own lives, the rivers do, and not just for as something that we can use. They're not just a tree to be cut down. They're something to be valued and preserved. And there certainly is a lot of work to do. And in a place like Utah, there's no wild and scenic rivers in Utah, for instance. There's no stretch of river, even though there are many that deserve it, or quite a few that deserve it. So there's always more to do.
And one thing that I also advocate is that when you look at water conservation, watershed preservation and preservation of rivers, it's not a right or left issue. You hear people from all across the political spectrum truly understanding. They get it when it comes to water in the West. We have to go all the way back to John Wesley Powell, who warned us more than 100 years ago. He said, be very, very careful because you're moving into an extraordinarily arid landscape that needs to be approached very carefully. These rivers of life, these rivers can help build life, but you need to be mindful of what can be tolerated and what cannot be tolerated in that unique landscape.
Hmm. One person who gets Powell's admonition is Terry Tempest Williams. I want to end with a clip from the film Five Rivers, Five Voices and get your response to her quite powerful statement.
Wilderness is a reservoir for our spirit, that it returns us to a place of dignity and humility, that it is a reminder that beauty is not optional, but a strategy for survival. And when he ends that wilderness letter with that great phrase, geography of hope, nowhere do we find that geography of hope more illuminated than in the great Western rivers.
Terry Tempest Williams, of course, quoting Wallace Stegner, and she gets it, right? Ken Verdoya.
The geography of hope. That's mm-hmm. that central thesis that was given to us by the extraordinary Utah-connected writer Wallace Stegner so many years ago. And his premise was that wild lands for the American consciousness, for the American soul, are critical because they help us reconnect with who we are as a people, the potential we have. And it's not that all of our landscape must be designated back to the frontier era, but to respect and preserve aspects of our wild lands as a means of protecting and sustaining ourselves. So that becomes, many people say it's a battle cry for environmental activism. What it is a call to common sense that we are the product of our decisions, and our decisions are cumulative. Whether they're made in the 1930s to control a flood, the 1950s to encourage Western economic development, or the 2010s, 2020s going forward to use water for other economic developments. We need to be mindful that our decisions are collective in nature. We carry them all forward. We have to be wise.
Mm-hmm. Roy Webb, what's your next river trip?
Well, I have a Grand Canyon trip in August. I do a history trip with a company that runs the Grand Canyon. I don't know. You know, I'm actually I'm looking forward to talking to my daughter, who just came off of Westwater, about her. She ran Skull Rapid and Funnel Falls, and she called me yesterday and was very proud of it. So I don't know. I'm going to keep track of sometimes you get a call from somebody who says, oh, I got a permit, let's go. And I'm tempted to go. So I'm always have an ear open for river opportunities.
And Ken, do you have summer plans?
The backyard of my cabin in Colorado is the Arkansas River. So mm-hmm. every summer I get there, and the first thing I do while the water is still up and running, I put a little rubber raft in the river with a couple of very good friends, and we spend a couple of days there getting our heads back in place.
Well, happy floating,
thank
everyone.
Thank you.
Ken Verdoya, Director of Production at KUED Channel 7. Roy Webb, he is with the Marriott Library Special Collections, also a river expert and river historian. His latest book, Lost Canyons of the Green River, the documentary Five Rivers, Five Voices, will air tonight at 8 o'clock on KUED Channel 7. More information is on our website, kcpw.org. Coming up next, bringing bees back to the garden, but first a break. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Here in the Beehive State, bees hold special emotional significance to us, but pollinators of all types have particular impact and a vital role in the garden. Today on the program, we're talking about the value of bees and how to prevent pollinator decline. Joining me this hour is Katie Wagner. She is an Extension Assistant Professor of Horticulture at the Utah State University Salt Lake Extension. She joins me in studio. If you have questions or comments about protecting pollinators and creating a bee-friendly garden, you can give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Katie Wagner's article, Bring Your Backyard to Life, is in the current edition of Edible Wasatch Magazine. There's a link on our website, kcpw.org. If you need tips for the garden, give us a call, 801-355-TALK. Before we get into some of the tips that you offer in your piece, Katie Wagner, what is the value of pollinators? Why should we care about bees?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, when we talk about pollinators, and I like to bring to people's attention, actually, that there are a lot of different types of pollinators. It's incredible. Certainly bees, but also some wasps, flies, beetles, butterflies, moths, birds, some bats even pollinate. And they move the pollen grains from the anther, which is the male flower part, to the stigma, the female flower part. And that, of course, gives us an amazing diversity of crops. It also helps to supply us abundant spices, but also pollinators actually pollinate more than 75% of flower plants. So really, they're amazing contributors to our biodiversity.
So plants, flowers, trees, they all depend on these pollinators. What kinds of You mentioned some wasps and some bees. Are there specific types of pollinators to the state of Utah?
Yeah, actually there are. A lot of times people think about pollination and bee pollination specifically, and they think of the European honeybee, which is not a native pollinator for us. That was brought over by the English colonists. We actually in Utah, believe it or not, have about 900 native species of bees that live here. Most of these bee species are solitary bees. Some species of sweat bees and bumblebees form colonies, but the rest of those bees are just out there in the environment living independently and giving us wonderful benefit through their pollination.
In recent years, there's been a lot of concern about something called colony collapse disorder. What do we know about colony collapse disorder? What is causing it, and can it be reversed?
Well, we're learning more and more every day, and full disclosure, I'm not an entomologist and not a specialist in colony collapse disorder, but I am very interested in it. Since 2006, commercial beekeepers have witnessed about a 33% annual loss in their hives. This was compared to about 15 to 22% prior to 2006. And colony collapse disorder is thought to be a factor of several different influences or stresses, diseases, pests, and then also impact with use of pesticides in our farms and in our residential areas are all thought to be contributors to colony collapse disorder. Interestingly enough, there is a new threat that was recently identified. It's a paper that was put out in December 2011, which looks at a parasitic fly. Really interesting. It's actually a native pest. It's known to previously parasitize bumblebee and paper wasp populations and decapitate certain varieties of ant species. But it looks like maybe it has jumped hosts and now it's going after our European honeybee. So just another concern out there with the ability of the honeybee to continue to provide all the important pollination services it currently does.
How big of a problem are the colony collapse disorder, this other threat that you mentioned here in Utah? Are we seeing a lot of that locally?
Yeah, sure. It's actually nationally we're seeing colony collapse disorder pressures. It's not just something that's happening in the United States, too. It's also happening in other parts of the world. Beekeepers are incredibly innovative people. They're very independent people, and they are constantly coming up with new ways to replace hives and to try to keep their bee populations where they need to be to provide the pollination services that the bees do. But it is a significant problem. And we do begin to worry over reliance of a single pollinator, which is experiencing pressures from these different factors.
We're speaking with Katie Wagner. She's an Extension Assistant Professor of Horticulture at the Utah State University Salt Lake Extension. She's written an article, Bring Your Backyard to Life, in the current edition of Edible Wasatch Magazine. There's a link on our website, kcpw.org. If you have questions or comments, we're talking about pollinators in the garden. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Let's go to Charlotte in Salt Lake City. Charlotte, hi.
Hi. I'm planting in a raised organic vegetable garden and some fruit, and I'm wondering, what can I do to further attract pollinators to my garden?
It's a good question. Thanks a lot for the call, Charlotte. Katie Wagner.
Yeah, I mean, one thing, Charlotte, I would really recommend that you do is go online, go to bees.usu.edu. There's a really fantastic publication on there called Gardening for Native Bees in Utah and Beyond. There's a really extensive list of pollinator plants that would be great for your garden. Something else, actually, that a lot of times people don't necessarily consider, which is a great way to attract pollinators to the garden, along with beneficial insects as well, to help you with your natural pest control is letting some of your herbs and vegetables go to bloom when they're ready. If you don't want them to reseed themselves, you can always clip those blooms before they form the mature seeds and are able to spread their seed that way. But it's a great way that you can really invite a lot of pollinators and beneficial insects into the garden. Also, planting a diversity of different types of pollinator plants, lots of different species. And one of the most important things to do is to provide a continuous source of pollen and nectar. So thinking about flower succession, and when one thing starts to exit bloom, having another pollinator plant there that's entering bloom so that there's always an abundant pollen and nectar source available for the pollinators.
Hmm. Charlotte, thanks very much for the call. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, talking about inviting bees to your garden. You talk about having a sense of timing with plants that are flowering and blooming, and then once one dies off, another comes into bloom. What kinds of specific plants work well in the garden here in Utah?
Oh, there are a lot of really great plants that work well here in Utah. We mentioned some of the herbs. Things like dill is a wonderful bloomer. Can also go with a lot of our native plants. Native plants are actually exceptional because they have a more nutritious source of nectar and pollen. A lot of our plants that we buy sometimes in our nurseries, they're really great as well, but oftentimes those plants are selected by plant breeders for things like showy blooms or maybe a wonderful fragrance. Sometimes they're even selected to be low in pollen for people with allergies. So utilizing some of the native plants that are available to us are a wonderful way that you can provide just that wonderful, nutritious pollen and nectar source for plants. Some of the agastaches are wonderful. Flax is a great plant. Showy milkweed is one, actually, that is a wonderful, wonderful pollinator plant. Globe mallow is another good one. So there are a lot of different possibilities. I like to spice up my garden personally with sunflowers. Sunflowers are fantastic pollinator plants, and they really are a beautiful addition as well in the garden. So I would encourage you to go to this online publication, The Gardening for Native Bees in Utah and Beyond.
Bees.utah.
Which you can find at bees.usu.edu.
Yep. We'll put a link on our website, kcpw.org. Yep. You mentioned sunflowers, and in your article in Edible Wasatch, you write, you advise people to plant Utah native plants. You also advise them to plant pollinators in warm, sunny areas. Why in a warm, sunny place?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, pollinators are little teeny tiny little insects out there. A lot of people don't realize that the European honeybee actually is a tropical animal. It only flies really when the temperature is around 52 degrees or higher. Also, for example, with the bees, they use the sun to orient themselves, and so it helps to give them direction as to where they are in the landscape. With the European honeybee, it helps the honeybee know where to turn back to go find its hive. So a warm, sunny area is very important. These guys don't tend to come out very well if it's cloudy or it's rainy, or if you're trying to place a hive in a shady area, they're not going to be able to forage as well as if you have them in a nice, sunny spot.
What about insecticides? I mean, a lot of gardeners out there need to get rid of some pests in order for their plants to grow. What effect does that have on pollinators?
Yeah, you should really try to avoid using insecticides. Some are worse than others. Broad-spectrum insecticides, active ingredients like carbaryl or malathion, are very, very toxic to bees. Those should be avoided if you can. Not spraying insecticides when the plants are in bloom is important. Obviously, trying to not spray if you see bees in the area. If you have to, early morning or late in the evening when the bees are at rest or not out flying around is a better time. But there are other techniques for pest control as well. And If you're more interested in this, you're welcome to contact the USU Extension Service. We use a term called integrated pest management. And integrated pest management is really a comprehensive approach to pest control. It's using all the tools in your toolbox to try to avoid the incidence of a infestation in the first place. So it would be things like picking pests off plants, looking for egg clusters and squashing them, placing barriers over crops like floating row crops. There's also some really exciting new findings in pheromone traps and trapping insects using pheromones. Or with your fruits, I get a lot of eye rolls with this one, I'll be honest with you, but it's a really great option is individually bagging fruit to prevent against some pests like the coddling moth and apple and pear. So all those things can help us to not have to be in a position where we have to use pesticides if we are worried about protecting the bees and other pollinators.
Katie Wagner, she's an Extension Assistant Professor of Horticulture at Utah State University's Salt Lake Extension. Her article, Bring Your Backyard to Life, is in the current edition of Edible Wasatch Magazine, and there's a link on our website, kcpw.org. Katie Wagner, thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you, Jennifer. Appreciate it.
City Views is a production of KCPW News. Thanks to Tamara Kemsley and Katie Sheen Abbott, and to Eric Ray, our technical director. Next time, Bonner Ritchie on Middle East peace. That's coming up tomorrow. For City Views, I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce.